allegations of vote counting irregularities. The prosecutors say they have not seen any unusual activity. Barr sent his memo after days of attacks on the integrity of the election by President Donald Trump and his Republican allies. Although Trump has refused to concede defeat, he said in recent remarks that time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be? I guess time will tell.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. Still, some of Trump's supporters, as well as his fellow Republicans, are refusing to budge and remain hopeful that their candidate still has the chance to become the next president. The controversy over the election results comes against the backdrop of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations. Trump supporters back his vote-rigging claims, while his opponents are happy with the projected victory of Joe Biden. Nevertheless, experts believe the nature of the U.S. regime will not change no matter who takes the reign at the White House.
What we're seeing is that the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous. And it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede.
Now, it remains to be seen who will be confirmed in office as the next U.S. president and whether or not there will be any major policy changes in the new administration.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland, and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept that countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world. And that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Insulting the Prophet is a manifestation of the dark, savage civilization of the West, November 11th, 2020.
The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries, in both the U.S. and European countries, but such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis. Just as the thugs in Mecca and Taif could not erase the name of the Holy Prophet of Islam, despite all the efforts that they made, these excellencies will not be able to damage the Holy Prophet either. These courses of action show the dark nature of the Western civilization. It indicates that that civilization and culture and that modern jahiliya, ignorance, is really dark and wild in its nature and in its reality.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, they're hiding this savagery. That is because they are equipped with science and technology. They cover their savagery up with science and technology and they hide it this way. They appear in public by uttering civilized words with a humanistic appearance and by wearing ties and perfume, thus covering up their inner savagery. So Islam and the Holy Prophet are not harmed this way, but this is a means so that you and I can gain a deeper understanding of that civilization. That civilization is really a wild civilization. It has also created a disastrous situation for its nations. In the present time, even after the passage of several centuries from the beginning of that civilization during the Renaissance, you can witness inequality, poverty, injustice, and moral decadence in European countries, in the U.S., and in those countries which follow them. This is the nature of that civilization and culture.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah.
The Debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. There are many who may consider Canada to be a safe haven for immigrants wishing to start a new life there. Yet horrible things happening to the black community, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants indicate a fact that although people can live there freely, they can never be equal to white Canadians. International rights organizations have reported an array of violations in Canada, including rights of Indigenous people, violence against Indigenous women and girls, children in immigration detention, mining industry abuses, and sexual orientation, as well as gender identity. Stay with us for a debate on that issue.
This is covered with food and mine, your treasure.
Canada has always been considered a safe haven for immigrants who come from across the world to start a new life in the Northern American country. But many believe that the terrible things that happen to the black community of Canada, the people of First Nation and non-white immigrants, suggest that although they can live freely in Canada, they can never be equal to white Canadians.
There's no systemic discrimination. There's no system in Quebec.
Thank God that we're different than the United States.
But experts believe that Canada has been actually founded on systemic discrimination, and the authorities' denial is part of the systemic racism. They say Canada's society has been made based on white supremacy. Systemic racism means normalizing racism. Non-white Canadians say they face systemic racism on an almost daily basis.
This country was founded on systemic discrimination.
The Canadian government says that Canada is radically different from the U.S. when it comes to racism. But the truth is, both countries have been founded on stolen and colonized lands. Both countries have attempted genocide on Indigenous people. And both countries have a dark history in slavery. And now, decades later, non-white and Indigenous communities of Canada are still struggling with police brutality. This attitude has also resulted in an increase in the number of hate crimes against non-white population of Canada. Joyce Achakwan heard racist and degrading comments from healthcare workers at a hospital in Montreal only moments before her death in September. She was one of the thousands of women who faced maltreatment because of her ethnicity. Canada has been coming to terms with racial injustice suffered by its Indigenous people in recent years. In 2019, a government inquiry found that Canada was complicit in, quote, race-based genocide against Indigenous women. The report said Indigenous women were 12 times more likely to be killed or disappear than other women in Canada. The inquiry said the cause was the deep-rooted colonialism and state inaction. It also found that persistent and deliberate human and Indigenous rights violations and abuses are the root cause behind Canada's staggering rates of violence. The Canadian government has repeatedly pledged to address these issues. But to this day, the number of racially motivated abuses still continues to rise.
Well, we got a couple of guests from Canada to discuss this. Joining me will be Chair of the Community Coalition Against Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone. We're joining us out of Hamilton, Ontario. We also have author and columnist Robert Fantina out of Kitchener, Ontario. Good to have both of you, gentlemen, on the show. Let's go to Ken. Major human rights organizations report serious rights violations in Canada. They include wide-ranging abuses against Indigenous people, the continued confinement of immigration detainees in jails, a prison law that does not rule out prolonged solitary confinement, the overseas operations of Canadian extractive companies, and on top of all of these, a growing number of Indigenous women and girls either going missing or being murdered. Can you educate us in more details about the human rights situation in Canada?
The Canadian government and the colonial empires that ran Canada before Confederation were based on a racist and capitalist colonization of North America in which Native people were considered as subhuman, and they were, from the very first contacts, killed on the spot. They were ethnically cleansed. Sometimes they were captured and made as household slaves. Later they were marginalized. Sometimes they were pressed into becoming the foot soldiers of one empire, the French or the British, against the other. They were used as workers in the colonial fur trade empires. They were finally marginalized onto reservations, with their lands taken away from them, their cultures destroyed. And what you see today is the result of 500 years of exploitation. It's not just Native people. As you correctly pointed out in the intro to this program, immigrants from all parts of the world have suffered racism in Canada. The Japanese were interned in World War II. The Chinese were subject to a head tax. The Sikhs were not prohibited to immigrate. The Jews were not given safe passage or allowed to come into country to free Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. The Orange Order was founded. It was continued here to keep the Irish down. It goes on and on. Racism has played a large role in Canada because the powers that be use it to exploit various groups at the lowest wages they can, and to turn groups against each other. And that's why we say that people who have suffered from racism need to unite with other people who have suffered from racism and discrimination and change this society fundamentally, right down to the roots of who holds power and why.
Right. Let me ask Robert this question. Robert, Indigenous women are 12 times more likely to be killed or disappeared than other women in Canada. And this is based on government inquiry last year that found Canada complicit in race-based genocide against Indigenous women. Where does this emanate from?
I think there are a couple of sources. One is that, as Mr. Stone said, Canada is a colonial nation. It's occupying Indigenous people's lands and continues to, and has for, of course, centuries. And that's this marginalization of the Indigenous women and men and children too is all part of that. Now, we have what's been referred to as missing white women syndrome. If a white woman goes missing, it's major news. Her picture is on all the news outlets. Tearful requests for her return are presented on the news programs. However, if a non-white woman is missing, it's not the case, because society has said they aren't as important, that women of color are simply not equal to women to white women. And this is a long-standing tradition, that may not be the right word, but it's built into the fabric of the country, because the country was founded on the genocide of the people who lived here for centuries. And mm-hmm. they've been pushed onto reservations, they've been marginalized, they live in terrible conditions. And this continues because it serves the needs of the white power structure. And mm-hmm. until that changes, nothing else is going to change for the people who are suffering.
Right. Now, Robert says that Canada was founded on the genocide. There are also some experts arguing that Canada was also founded on a systemic discrimination and white superiority. What's your opinion?
Absolutely. The people who founded what is now Canada, that is to say, the people who took over and colonized what is now Canada, the British and the French mainly, the British had the view that they had a white man's burden to lift up the native people and bring them up to the standard, their standards. Of course, they never did that. The French had the mission of civilization, the mission civilatrice, where they would bring the poor heathens into the Roman Catholic religion and teach them the right way. These were just the cover stories for their systemic racism. They had no intention of ever bringing these people into full participation in society. And in fact, in some cases, such as in Newfoundland, the British colonial government there participated in the extermination of the Beothuks, which is a shameful chapter in Canadian history. Canadian society, right until this day, it's a class society, and the people who are at the top of the class are mainly white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant males, and they seek to maintain their domination through a system of policing, laws, jails, denial of opportunities for education, medical care, housing, and every other aspect of society you can think of to the people at the bottom, and who are largely native. Mm-hmm. But there's also people who are at the bottom who are of color, people who are black, new immigrants. They are all put through the mill. And it's a self-perpetuating system whereby the people at the top use the racism to turn white people against people of color and people of other ethnic origins and native people. And for years, for centuries, this has gone on. But there has been a growing anti-racist movement and a growing movement of solidarity with native people that is pulling together people from all these groups and demanding equality and justice and restorative justice for the native people, especially, who have lost their lands, their culture, their health, their dignity, who had their children taken away from them in the residential school system. Canada, as you said, has made strides in the last number of years in trying to restore, have some kind of accounting and change. And we have to applaud the people who have done that, and the certain changes in government where they've paid out land claims, they've paid compensation for the residential schools, they've made apologies, they've had royal commissions without an end. Unfortunately, you could paper your house with all the recommendations from those piles and piles of royal commission reports that have never been implemented. Nonetheless, the struggle continues, and it's the duty of all Canadians, whatever color, to help to support the native people in their struggles, such as the one that's taking place just a few miles from where I'm sitting, where the 1492 Land Back Group is taking back a piece of land on which a developer wished to make a new subdivision. I had the pleasure of joining with a trade union delegation of solidarity that went to see them and bring them supplies the other day. That's the kind of thing that Canadians have to do.
Right. Now, Robert, the Ottawa government is saying that Canada is radically different from the United States when it comes to racism. Do you agree? Could you kind of draw a comparison between the two?
Canada seems to paper it over a little bit more carefully, but the racism is still there. This is seen in some of the statistics that you mentioned earlier regarding the disappearances and deaths of indigenous women. Also, the United Nations Proclamation on the Rights of Indigenous People was passed, and earlier this year, a bill was introduced into the Canadian Parliament to bring standards up to that, and it did not pass. So this is, again, where an attempt was made to try to bring things more equal, try to end the racism, and it failed, which is something that one would expect in the United States. But Canada has this image of not being racist. But we look at the same kinds of situations. We look at the number of non-whites who are in solitary confinement. We look at the number of immigrants who are caged. In the U.S. for a time, that was there was outrage against that, but that passed. It's old news, but it's still happening. But it continues to happen. It happens also, perhaps to a lesser degree, but also in Canada. There's other systemic racism. It is part and parcel of the establishment of the nation of Canada, the same way it was part of the establishment of the nation of the United States. It's endemic in its society and in its makeup, and changing it is not going to be easy, but it must be done.
Right. Canada government, as you know, has repeatedly promised to deal with, you know, such issues that we're talking about. It's also pledged a long-awaited national inquiry on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, but it has failed to do so. Why is that the case?
It's not a priority for the government. As the Mr. Fantino said in previous comment, the Canadian government doesn't live up to its international obligations concerning Indigenous peoples, and it doesn't live up to even its own promises of what it will do to help Native people in Canada. And one of those is the missing and murdered Indigenous women. The commission has gone on for years. I don't see any radical changes about to take place. And I'm afraid probably that any recommendations will probably end up on the shelf gathering dust, along with the other royal commissions that have taken place over the last 40 or 50 years. So I think that it's up to ordinary Canadians to take a stand here, to become active in their communities, and to take a positive role in fighting racism. I think that, in fact, that's the only way that things change in Canada, is when there's a grassroots pressure on the government to do something. For example, in this particular, in the case of pipelines, when the government wanted to put a pipeline through the Wet'suwet'en lands, and people took to the streets, and people blocked roads, people blocked highways and railway tracks.
Right.
That forces the government to come to terms. And even now in Caledonia, just a few miles from here, where the 1492 Land Act has been holding out for a couple of months now, despite arrests, being shot at with rubber bullets, being beaten by police, they're holding out. And now there's talk that the federal and provincial governments may sit down to negotiate something, which is something they should have done at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. In fact, they never even bothered to consult the traditional leadership of the Haudenosaunee people, that is to say, the leadership, the traditional chiefs of the Six Nations,
right,
who have been sitting on the, you know, brought into Canada and settled here as a result of the American Revolutionary War around 1784. So they've been here over 200 years on that land, and that land has been taken away from them progressively, year chunk by chunk, year by year. Now they want some of it back, and they're going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert, Canada is also continuously exporting military equipment and weapons to countries with a record of human rights violations. Can you tell us something about this?
Yes, this is another violation of human rights that's a stain on Canada's record. Canada does export weapons, does sell weapons to anyone who wants to buy them, and this is in the U.S. model, certainly. It's certainly lucrative for the government, and it brings in quite a bit of revenue, but it is still in violation of international law. These other countries should not be receiving weapons unless and until they can bring their human rights practices up to at least a minimum standard, which they don't do. The Canadian government must immediately stop these sales. It's a violation of human rights within Canada because it violates Canadian law, but also it fosters the violation of human rights by these other countries. They continue to oppress their people, to kill their people and other people. So it's as if Canada is pulling the trigger and dropping the bombs themselves by providing this weaponry. This is another thing that needs to stop, and that is the Canadian government seems to hide sometimes. It's not clearly recognized how much weaponry that Canada does sell to other countries and who it sells it to. But if this were known, Canada would lose its undeserved reputation as a peacemaker and as a country that fosters diplomacy and justice. These are myths unfortunately, that the government has fostered, but the reality is simply not the case.
Okay, that will come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had Chair of the Community Coalition Against Racism in Hamilton, Ken Stone, who joined us from Hamilton, Ontario, and author and journalist Robert Fentina out of Kitchener, Ontario. I'm your host, Behruz Neja.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a new report released by the archival group Perilous, a chronicle of prisoner unrest on 13th of November, incarcerated people in the U.S. collectively organized at least 106 COVID-19-related rebellions from 17th of March to 15th of June. Perilous, a volunteer collective project that tracks information on all prison uprisings, riots, protests, strikes, and other unrest within carceral facilities, described this activity as clearly one of the most massive waves of prisoner resistance in the past decade. Duncan Tarr, a researcher at Perilous, said, "Since correction departments and immigration and customs enforcement contractors are unwilling to prevent the spread of the virus, prisoners and detainees have been taking action themselves to draw attention to the dangerous situation they find themselves in and to resist the system of incarceration that is killing them." Perilous's analysis found that people rose up inside federal and state prisons, jails, juvenile carceral facilities, and immigration detention centers in 39 states. Immigrant detention centers rebelled most frequently, with 45 separate events. 32 rebellions took place in private prisons, 25 of which had contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, a disproportionate response, as less than 9% of prisons in the United States are privately operated. Here we present you an article written by Ella Fassler, an independent writer and researcher based in Rhode Island, United States, under the heading, "Report Finds Over 100 Rebellions in U.S. Jails and Prisons Over COVID Conditions." The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Please stay with us for more of Ella Fassler's article. U.S. jails and prisons, already death traps, have been completely ravaged by COVID-19. Crowded quarters, a lack of personal protective equipment, inadequate medical care, and an aging population, and unsanitary conditions have contributed to an infection rate 5.5 times higher than the already ballooned average in the United States. As of Friday, 13th of November, over 252,000 people in jails and prisons have been infected, and at least 1,450 incarcerated people and officers have died from the novel coronavirus. However, evidence suggests that these figures are underreported. For example, the entire state of Wisconsin isn't releasing any information to the public. In response, incarcerated people have shown strong solidarity, coming together to demand baseline safety measures and advocating for their release, only to be met with brutal repression and punishment. According to a new report released by the archival group Perilous, a chronicle of prisoner unrest on 13th of November, incarcerated people in the United States collectively organized at least 106 COVID-19 related rebellions from 17th of March through to 15th of June. Perilous, a volunteer collective project that tracks information on all prison uprisings, riots, protests, strikes, and other unrest within the carceral facilities, described this activity as clearly one of the most massive waves of prison resistance in the past decade. Duncan Tarr, a researcher at Perilous, tells truthout.org, since correction departments and immigration and customs enforcement contractors are unwilling to prevent the spread of the virus, prisoners and detainees have been taking action themselves to draw attention to the dangerous situation they find themselves in and to resist the system of incarceration that is killing them. Perilous's analysis found that people rose up inside federal and state prisons, jails, juvenile carceral facilities, and immigration detention centers in 39 states. Immigrant detention centers rebelled most frequently with 45 separate events. 32 rebellions took place in private prisons, 25 of which had contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, a disproportionate response as less than 9% of prisons in the United States are privately operated. Louisiana, with a rich history of work stoppages and rebellions, was the state with the highest frequency of COVID-19-related prison rebellions. California and Washington State were the second and third most rebellious states, respectively. Common demands have included that prison guards wear face masks and that departments provide individuals with protective items like soap, face masks, and hand sanitizers. In early April, an estimated 120 to 180 detainees inside GEO Group's Adelanto ICE Processing Center in California went on hunger strike after two individuals exhibiting COVID-19 symptoms were sent to the hospital. Striker Marcos Duran told Perilous that the private prison guards weren't wearing face masks. Duran said detainees did not have access to soap or shampoo, were forced to eat alongside 50 to 60 other detainees, and slept in the same room as seven others. According to Desert Sun, as of 7th of October, nearly 20% of detainees at Adelanto Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility had contracted COVID-19. Beyond hunger strikes, Perilous documented 21 uprisings in American prisons, defined as collective acts of rebellion that exceed the usual scope of a protest through unpredictable or chaotic means. In Monroe, Washington, after six incarcerated people and five staff members were diagnosed with COVID-19, an estimated 100 to 200 incarcerated people staged a protest over inadequate protective measures and a downplaying of the virus in the recreation yard at Monroe Correctional Complex on 8th of April this year. Joshua Vermatt, an incarcerated person at the Monroe Correctional Complex, described his concerns in a letter to a friend, excerpts of which were published in Quo and NPR. He said the Department of Corrections was transferring uninfected incarcerated people into contaminated tiers. He wrote, "We've been safe until now, but because of their lack of foresight and proper planning, now they need rooms for more vulnerable inmates and they want us to go into the hot zone to make room for them." He added, "They tried to bribe us with McDonald's food. Are you flipping kidding? If you would do anything, I ask you to tell this to the news and to the governor. This isn't right. Some prisoners refuse orders to move. According to the Department of Corrections, their grievances were met with chemical weapons, rubber bullets, and sting balls. Demonstrators were ultimately forced to surrender. The next day, Vermaat said the resistance led to a change in tone from the Department of Corrections, but that the facility went on lockdown. He noted, "No one here wants violence. No one, but at the same time, you've got 400-plus prisoners who are now being backed into corners." 1 month later, a security guard at Monroe Correctional Facility died from COVID-19. Cook County Jail in Chicago, Illinois, a site with the largest outbreak of any location in the state of Illinois, rebelled on 6 separate occasions, including one uprising and several hunger strikes. On at least one occasion, some detainees attempted or threatened to attempt suicide. Over the course of April, the jail had released nearly a fourth of its population, decreasing it from 5,604 to 4,301. But despite early resistance, Cook County Jail's population has crept up again to nearly pre-pandemic levels. COVID-19 flare-ups behind bars have undoubtedly contributed to the United States' abysmal failure to control the virus. Despite urgent calls for action from public health scientists in The Lancet, the ACLU, and countless other organizations, Democratic and Republican politicians alike, from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, have largely refused to reduce prison populations by any meaningful margin. In the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU's evaluation of state efforts to prevent COVID-19 deaths behind bars, Colorado, Kentucky, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, Oregon, Tennessee, Vermont, and West Virginia received the best scores, all with a D. After sustained activism and a mounting death toll, on 4th of November, New Jersey released more than 2,000 incarcerated people who were already nearing the end of their sentences. In the face of negligence, Ivan Von Steik, an incarcerated person at the notoriously brutal San Quentin State Prison, filed a lawsuit in May against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, charging deliberate indifference to the risk of substantial harm to inmates by failing to immediately reduce the prison population of San Quentin by releasing or transferring at least 50% of the population of the prison. After the court filing, San Quentin suffered an outbreak of at least 2,500 cases and at least 29 deaths. On 20th of October, the First District Court of Appeal in California ruled in Von Steik's favor, ordering the release or transfer of nearly 1,500 incarcerated individuals. The court wrote, "If necessary to achieve this reduction, respondents are ordered to revise their expedited release programs to include inmates over the age of 60 who have served at least 25 years of their sentences and are eligible for parole, such as life prisoners eligible for parole and second or third strike prisoners, even if such prisoners are serving a sentence for a violent offense." However, incarcerated people and public health experts warned that transfers increased the spread of COVID-19. San Quentin's massive outbreak resulted from transfers. Christopher Blackwell, an incarcerated man at Monroe Correctional Facility, previously told Truth Out the best way to help keep prisoners from contracting the virus would be mass releases. He added, "Absent those, it is essential to cease transfers and provide incarcerated people with adequate supplies." As the United States enters its third wave of coronavirus infections, instead of mass release of prisoners, many departments' chosen preventative measures continue to be lockdowns, or confining people to their cells for 21 to 23 hours a day. It's estimated that 300,000 people incarcerated in state and federal prisons are in lockdown or solitary confinement conditions. Many incarcerated people have lost phone privileges and already scant programming. According to Perilous Report, as budgets are slashed, without complementary mass releases, healthcare services behind bars will continue to deteriorate. Prior to COVID-19, experts considered U.S. prisons to be ticking time bombs. Baseline volatile conditions remain that the virus is an accelerant. There is some hope that the virus will be better managed once next U.S. president takes power, although both Donald Trump and Joe Biden have not yet released a plan that puts people over profit. Duncan Tarr hopes that the Perilous Report will bring some attention to the struggle behind bars during this chaotic time. He said, as the national political crisis continues to play out over the next few months, it is important that some of the most vulnerable to COVID-19, those locked up by U.S. government, are not forgotten, and that their cries for help and freedom do not go unheard. He added, and a close look at the first few months of their resistance to the pandemic can shed some light on how we might move forward in preventing more unneeded deaths inside prison walls.